postpartum body odor. It is a totally natural phenomenon because your body chemistry changes after giving birth. And so sometimes that means that what worked before is no longer effective. But I am excited to say that now there is a solution for that stubborn odor. The Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant is a completely natural deodorant made by a postpartum mom who went through it herself. And it works by eliminating and preventing bacterial body odor without covering up your skin's comforting smell to your baby while giving you 12 hours of odor control. And let me tell you, it actually works. Here at the house, we've all been trying it and loving it. Now, before you think, ew, you're sharing a deodorant with your husband and daughter, let me explain that this full body deodorant comes in a convenient pump applicator that lets you apply it anywhere on your body with no bacteria traveling on the deodorant, so no ew involved. We also love that the Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant has a delightful natural scent of USDA certified organic extracts that smell like a pink sugar cookie with lemon frosting. I thought this would be a little strange, but it's actually amazing. Also, the Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant is free from artificial fragrances and any kind of senoestrogens or herbs that can interfere with breastfeeding. Find your Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant at postpartumdeodorant.com. That's postpartumdeodorant.com and use the code BIRTHFUL for 20% off through the month of May. Get your Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant now at postpartumdeodorant.com and start smelling more like yourself again. Now that we're in full spring mode, I am constantly reaching for my Jenny Kane Crop Cashmere Cocoon Cardigan because I find it is the perfect level of warm and cozy for when there's still a light chill in the air, but I don't want a coat. And like so many of Jenny Kane's bestsellers, this 100% cashmere cardigan is just so versatile. So I can wear it on its own over dresses, short sleeves, long sleeves, with slacks or jeans. It works with all of it, which is a really good thing because I just never want to take it off. And of course, this cardigan has the impeccable and luxurious level of craftsmanship that you can expect from all of Jenny Kane's products. Jenny Kane is a California brand through and through, and so think minimalist and effortless, but totally refined. Because they are a sponsor of the podcast, for a limited time, our listeners can get 15% off their first order while supporting our show. Go to jennykane.com and use the code BIRTHFUL15 to get 15% off. Now, I know that I go on and on about Jenny Kane sweaters because I'm frankly obsessed, but they also have everything you could want to finish out your look. They have dresses, shoes, and even a stunning collection of home essentials. Curate a wardrobe that never goes out of style at jennykane.com. As a Birthful listener, get 15% off your first order when you use the code BIRTHFUL15 at checkout. That's 15% off your first order at jennykane.com, promo code BIRTHFUL15. Let getting dressed be one less thing to worry about. Welcome to Birthful, Mighty Parent or Parent-to-Be. I'm Adriana Losada, and for this next episode in our Nutrition and Nourishment series, we're going to explore how what you eat during pregnancy can end up impacting your baby's microbiome. And after hearing what my guest has to say, you may not be as worried about pooping during childbirth, I'm just saying. Now, if you have listened to the other episodes in this series, you know I'm practically on a quest to figure out if there's anything you can do proactively during pregnancy or even before to help you minimize your chances of Group B strep colonization. And of course, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to ask a microbiologist about this. I mean, who better, right? The microbiologist in question is Dr. Anne Estes, who, aside from being an assistant professor, microbiome researcher, and mother of two, is also, as she says, the human host of the blog Mostly Microbes. In her blog, Anne helps distinguish research findings from hype, focusing on the microbiome, especially from pregnancy through the first 5 years of life, because she feels that that is the time where we can make the biggest microbial health impact. In our conversation, Anne will be sharing a bit about how your baby's microbiome gets seeded. We're going to ponder if microbes have anything to do with pregnancy cravings. And we end up having a really interesting conversation about how ethnicity can affect the microbiome. You're listening to Birthful, here to inform your intuition. Welcome, Anne. I am so happy to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Yay. And so you've been surrounded and analyzing and looking at microbes for quite a long time.
I have. I've always been fascinated with how microbes influence their larger hosts.
We've been hearing a lot about birth and the microbiome, but what about the seeding of the microbiome during pregnancy itself? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I want to back up one step first and start with, we're talking about when we say microbiome, you know, that is such a vague term. So really what we're talking about today is we'll be talking about, you know, the vaginal microbiome, which is one set of microbes that are very unique, versus the gut microbiome, which is also a totally different set of microbes that's very unique and separate from the vaginal microbiome. And then you've even got breast microbiome, breast milk microbiome. You've got, you know, microbiomes everywhere. So what you're referring to with the seeding is the idea that a lot of times, and I'm sure all your listeners know this, but just to get us all on the same page, we started seeing that when babies were born in a C-section instead of vaginally, they had very different microbiomes. And this also seemed to correlate with increased obesity and allergies and asthma and all these other things. And diabetes. So what happened, I'm not sure if this is the exact origin story, but I'm pretty sure it is. One of the lead microbiome researchers, Rob Knight, who's now out in California, his wife had emergency C-section. And he had been doing enough research and knew about this difference in the microbiota between C-section babies and vaginal babies. And so the way he tells the story is, they had an emergency C-section after, you know, making all these plans for vaginal birth. And when they had to have an emergency C-section, he always has cotton swabs in his bag because he's a dorky microbiologist. I mean, we have all sorts of crazy things we carry around, right? So he immediately told his wife that what he wanted to do was to swab her vagina and then cover the baby. So as soon as the doctors left the room, they started swabbing their infant girl. And it took them hours, but they finally felt like they had swabbed her effectively. And because he's really excited about microbiome work, he's tracked himself and his wife and his daughter for quite some time now. And I don't think he's published that data, but he's talked about it several times. So anyway, after that, then Maria Gloria Bella Dominguez has started actually doing more work looking at which is a proof of principles of vaginal seeding. So the idea is that when you have a C-section baby, you incubate a swab in mom's vagina for an hour before C-section. And then when the baby comes out, you swab their mouth, you swab their ears, nose, everything, and then full body in trying to mimic that vaginal birth. Of course, you're not truly mimicking vaginal birth because you're missing the hormones, you're missing the squeezing, you're missing so many other aspects that we still don't know about with birth. And so those things could also be playing into why we have these different microbiomes. But the idea with seeding is that maybe you'll try and replace some of the difference between the C-section and vaginal birth. And of course, that's also talking about scheduled C-sections. With emergency C-sections, what we're seeing is that a lot of times these are pretty far along in labor when they happen. And so it seems like either the water's already broken or, again, perhaps it's these hormone differences or squeezing or whatever. Emergency C-section infants do have microbiomes more similar to vaginally born infants. So there is something to be said for it's really not just the procedure of C-section, but it seems like it's the process of labor that's important as well.
Mm-hmm.
What do I think of seeding? I think as long as people I think in the U.S. we really are very careful about screening for Group B strep, which is quite honestly pretty rare in terms of causing complications. But because when it does cause complications, they are so dramatic, we want to be really cautious with that. So as long as mom's getting screened for GBS and she's talked to her doctor and things like that, I can completely understand doing vaginal seeding.
Mm-hmm. And so I think what I was trying to get, and I love that you went through all that information because...
Sorry.
Yeah, no, because it is totally important to know that the difference and that there's research being done out there to try to figure out how to even make this a protocol. But I think I was trying to go back to, while still pregnant, we used to think the placenta was this great filter, and now we know that it filters some things. It's still fantastic and great and, you know, super mighty, but it does let a lot of things go through because it's a symbiotic environment, right? So at that point, my understanding is that there is some seeding of the baby's microbiome by just being inside the body, being, you know, through the placenta in the womb. Can you talk to us about that part?
So that research, I think the majority of microbiome scientists do not feel comfortable thinking that that seeding occurs of the infant in utero. The data really aren't strong enough yet to say that the placenta has a microbiome in healthy babies and that this happens in utero. I honestly, from the different data that I've looked at and from conversations with a number of people, am still most comfortable thinking about the idea that the baby is primarily gets their bacteria at birth. So, you know, there probably is a little bit because the meconium seems to have something, but at the same time, we could be biased by the techniques we're using because with the, and I'm not going to get into the details of the techniques, but when you don't have much DNA to sample, which would be the case in the meconium, you're more likely to get false positives, to get something that is there when it truly isn't. So I think the jury's still out, and if anything, is still leaning towards the placenta not being inhabited by microbes or a place for microbes to cross through during a healthy birth. It might be different in preterm births.
Interesting. Okay. So that like tears apart my knowledge. It doesn't completely tear it apart. But it narrows the focus more in that since baby's microbiome is being seeded during a vaginal birth, mainly, right? That would be the ideal seeding.
Yeah.
And such seeding has to do with the vaginal microbiome. What can she do during pregnancy, or is there anything, or is there a point to them doing anything during pregnancy to have like the most optimal vaginal microbiome for that moment?
Yeah, fabulous question. So I don't think it tears your ideas apart at all. I think it's just a switch in the way of thinking of it, because really the microbiome we can control probably the most is our gut microbiome, and it's the one that we know the most about. And when everybody talks about vaginal seeding and seeding of babies and infants, they focus on just the vagina. But I can't tell you how many different comments and things I've heard from different women saying that one of their greatest fears is pooping on the delivery table. And you know, as a biologist, like, poop doesn't bother me. I work with dung beetles, so, you know, that wasn't ever one of my concerns. But as a mom, and then also in starting to think more about birth and talking to doula friends, you know, the baby comes out, unless it's my baby, which both my babies were sunny side up, but babies generally rotate so that their mouth and nose are at the anus, and they're picking up bacteria from poop, from the GI tract, too. They're not just picking up vaginal bacteria. They're picking up stuff from your gut. And that's what we can really do the most about. So that's where moms can be paying attention to, you know, what they're eating and going back to the good old what mom told you, which are the fruits and vegetables and things like that and fermented foods. So I still think that diet is one of the most important things that women can do to have a healthy microbiome for themselves and their baby and start the baby off right.
Okay. Wow. My mind's being blown again.
Welcome to the world of microbiomes.
Now we're thinking about poop. So what should people be considering or paying attention to during pregnancy, you know, looking forward to that better seeding during the birth?
So there are some really interesting studies going back to the gut microbiome work where your gut microbiome changes dramatically depending on if you're eating fruits and vegetables or a vegan diet even versus meats and cheeses and lots of dairy. And honestly, all of your different microbes need a variety of foods. They don't need just one or just the other, because a lot of your E. coli that actually are helpful and produce some of the vitamins we need, like vitamin B and some of the B vitamins and vitamin K, those actually use meat and cheeses to make those vitamins. So just going on one kind of diet extreme or the other is not a good thing, I don't think, from my reading. But just having a balanced diet and leaning more heavily to your plant-based, unprocessed food, like, you know, cooked vegetables or steamed vegetables or even raw vegetables, but just getting away from the hyper-processed stuff that I think most of us find easiest to find in high abundance and cheaply, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then also feeding on fermented foods as well.
Which is a whole other fascinating topic. What about supplementation with like probiotics or prebiotics during pregnancy?
Yeah, that's a fabulous question. So your prebiotics, in my mind, are fruits and vegetables. You know, it's what you're feeding your microbiome. So, you know, for my kids, like my oldest, both of them started off really well as toddlers in eating anything and everything. And their care providers were always shocked that they would eat spinach with cumin and things like that. But that's just what they were used to. And until my oldest hit about 4 or 5, and then she started finding out about mac and cheese and looking at what it was in everybody else's lunch. And then it all started going downhill from there. But I've gotten her back by talking about those good bacteria and what she needs to feed them so they can be healthy and happy. And it's the same thing for us. I mean, the director of our institute, Claire Fraser, who sequenced the very first bacterial genome ever, she was funny. Hearing her talk one day, she was saying, you know, I'm like anybody else. I see cake in the fridge and I see a salad. I want the cake. I don't want that salad. But I know I need to eat that salad so that I'll feel better. You know, and there is a big connection between there's the gut-brain axis we're starting to learn a lot about, where it seems like our bacteria are actually producing some of the compounds that help with our mood regulation and things like that. So again, it's back to that good old, you know, reduce your sugar and eat lots of fruits and vegetables, and those are the prebiotics. Now, for probiotics, I'm still kind of a little humbuggish, I guess, about most probiotics. I think that the average person who actually is in good health, meaning you don't have any digestive system disorders, you know, you don't have irritable bowel syndrome or Crohn's disease or any of those things. And also, you know, it seems like depression and anxiety are part of that balance as well. So you can kind of switch your microbiome a little bit by changing what you're feeding for those organisms as well, eating more fish oils and healthy oils and things like that. But I, you know, in my mind, as an ecologist, as my fundamental training, what you have already picked up when you were a small child and then throughout your life is really what's going to be there. They're the critters that have already moved in. So sometimes I think of this as an apartment building or a dorm. So when you're filling up your apartment building or dorm, you want good residents. You want somebody who's going to pay their bills. They're going to keep the place clean. They're going to, you know, go to sleep and not, or at least not have loud parties. And so that's, you know, feeding your microbiome properly using fruits and vegetables and healthy oils can promote those good folks coming in. But, you know, once the rooms are occupied, you can't put any more people in there. If it's only one person per room, it's one person per room. So those spaces are filled. And you can't, even if there's a disruptive person who wants to come in and be in that dorm or in that apartment building, there's no space for them, so they can't live there. But if you start having people move out, your good neighbors moving out for whatever reason, then your disruptive neighbors can come in. So probiotics, in my mind, are kind of more like the disruptive neighbors. They come in, they might be good, they might be bad, or helpful or not helpful, but they're not going to live there with you unless there's a space for them to live. Now, that being said, they can still come by and stand outside your window and make a lot of noise and be a pain in the butt, or they can plant flowers outside of your window and, you know, make the landscape beautiful. So they can still do things that would influence your interaction and your well-being, but they're not going to take up permanent residence there. So that's the way I see probiotics. You know, there are some that if you're having real digestive system problems, then you can take antibiotics and try to get rebalanced using them. But there's not that many that have really gone through clinical trials and I think are substantive.
Yum, delicious, tasty, super clean water. That is what we now happily drink thanks to our AquaTrue Reverse Osmosis Water Purifier. It's just so much easier for us to stay hydrated. For me, that is vital because I am prone to getting headaches, and so being well hydrated really helps with that. And if you're pregnant or nursing, being well hydrated is also vital for you because good hydration is key during this time of life. AquaTrue purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process that removes 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters, and they have water purifiers to fit every type of home, from installation-free countertop purifiers to higher capacity under-sink options. They even have a Wi-Fi connected purifier and mineral boost options. Also, their filters are affordable and long-lasting with just one set of filters from their classic purifier, making the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. Using AquaTrue water can even improve the taste of your coffee, tea, and anywhere else you use water to cook, like for making rice, quinoa, stocks, or soups. I truly can't say enough good things about my AquaTrue. AquaTrue also comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee and even makes a great gift. Today, my listeners receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. Just go to AquaTrue.com. That's AquaTrue.com and enter code BIRTHFUL at checkout. That's 20% off any AquaTrue water purifier when you go to AquaTrue.com and use the promo code BIRTHFUL. With Mother's Day coming up fast, are you looking to get your mom, grandma, or mother figure a gift that they'll actually love? You know, something that is treasured instead of dying out or collecting dust? If so, you need to know about MyLifeInABook.com, which is a service that helps turn their life stories into a beautiful book that can be passed down. How amazing is that? And the process couldn't be easier. Basically, if they can use email, they can create their book. Every week, My Life in a Book will send them an email with a prompt question to get them started. And if they don't like the question, they can easily edit it or change it. We gave a My Life in a Book to a family member that always wants to document all family get-togethers through images. And let me tell you, the process of sending the gift was super simple, even letting us choose the date we wanted the gift to be sent. I'm so looking forward to discovering stories about her youth, her adventures, and the challenges she has overcome. And since My Life in a Book lets you add an image with each answer, she can now share the story that goes along with her many photos. Another great thing is that the answers can be edited at any time before the book is printed, in case she wants to add anything else. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code BIRTHFUL at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code BIRTHFUL for 10% off today. So, you know how during pregnancy and we've been told to avoid this, don't eat that, you know, don't have the the raw egg. And is that, do those recommendations from what you said, are those enough to kick out, you know, to kick out the neighbors and create more space? Or is it something like, it's not really going to affect your microbiome in the long term or during the pregnancy?
Awesome. Yeah. So actually, that's where it's a little bit different with pregnant women, right? Because our immune systems are a little bit more sensitive compared to that of most people. So that we're not rejecting our fetus, right? So in that case, you know, you are still susceptible to things like salmonella and listeria and some of those bad guys. They can still get in because you have so many different versions of your immune system. There's the microbiome plays an important part, just the barriers that are present, whether it's the mucus layer of your gut or whether it's the skin layer, if you're talking about the outside of your body. Then you also have your backup immune system, which is your innate immune system, where your body is actually attacking things like your white blood cells and things like that. So yeah, I would not solely rely on my microbial partners to do it all. Again, I think we're these organisms that are really a collection of both microbes and humans. So we need both parts of those, especially when you're pregnant, when your immune system is, your human part of your immune system is ratcheted down a little bit. So yeah, I would still avoid deli meats for listeriosis. That is a nasty, nasty bacterium. And you know, wash things carefully and be careful of salmonella and unbaked meats and things like that.
Okay. Big concern for moms during pregnancy and birth is the status of their group B strep.
Oh, yes.
And that is something that's definitely microbial, right?
Yes.
So is there a microbiological, I don't know if that's a word, but microbiological way to discourage the presence of GBS during pregnancy and so hopefully have a negative GBS test outcome because you don't have a prevalence of GBS and don't have to have antibiotics during birth, which can then affect your baby's microbiome as they come through and in that seeding moment? So walking it back, can we do anything?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I remember being so worried about that group B strep test in both, with both of my pregnancies and even with my first one where, you know, she's 8 now and we didn't know so much of what we know now then. It was just my natural kind of fear of antibiotics, unnecessary antibiotics, I should say, because I certainly take antibiotics when I need them. But anyway, yeah, so group B strep is really interesting. It's another one of those interesting bacteria in that for the majority of people who have it, it's not a problem. And in fact, I think it's only like 1% of babies who are born who are colonized by group B strep actually end up having some sort of complication due to that. And it may even be less than that. I should have double checked on that number. But it's really not, as much as we worry about it, the ramifications of group B strep, which are really frightening things, actually don't happen that often. The problem is when they happen, it happens quickly. And it's one of those things that, you know, as a mom, you're always told, oh, if your baby's temperature gets over 104, you know, it's an emergency. And that's why, because one of the things group B strep potentially causes is meningitis. So in that case, you know, you really want to catch it quick, deal with it. And so it can be kind of easy in those early infant weeks that are so crazy to potentially miss that and then have serious complications. So that's why we worry so much about group B strep. So that being said, a lot of people are carriers. How can you deal with it? So in some of this new vaginal microbiome studies that I was looking at, it's interesting because they really have found that women across, they did longitudinal sampling of women across time. So they took non-pregnant and pregnant women and followed them and took samples, you know, every so many weeks. I don't remember how many weeks. But they surveyed them from first through third trimester, all the way through birth, actually. And they looked to see if their bacterial communities in the vagina, because that is where group B strep lives, if the bacterial communities change over pregnancy. And what they saw was that it really didn't change so much. There were a few times when it changed, but in pregnant women, overall, the community stayed pretty similar. So women who are dominated by lactobacillus, like lactobacillus enters, they keep that throughout their pregnancy. Non-pregnant women, their microbiome, vaginal microbiome communities fluctuate a lot more than that. And that's probably, or that seems to be correlated with hormonal changes throughout the month. So that's kind of interesting and helpful that it's stable and suggests that you're not going to drastically change from one state to another. However, group B strep can come in and invade, and that can cause potential problems even in the last few days. So, you know, the thing is, like, there's not, we're still at the infancy with so much of this. I mean, these studies, even look, the first study doing this longitudinal sampling to see if we even have similar microbiomes in the vagina, one place that has relatively few number of bacteria. You know, that study wasn't even done until 2014, and they were looking more for BV than they were bacterial vaginosis than they were worried about group B strep. So the answer is, I don't really know. I know there are some probiotics under clinical trial now. People are looking into to see if they can give lactobacillus suppositories, effectively vaginal suppositories, and keep the balance more towards lactobacillus and keep those bad neighbors of group B strep from coming out and overgrowing. But we're just not there. So, you know, again, the best recommendation, I think, is just to keep eating healthy fruits and vegetables and, you know, have your yogurt. Make sure it's, you know, yogurt that has active cultures, and drink your kefir. The one thing you do need to worry about with fermented foods, or at least my experience with fermented foods, is, and I need, this is something else I need to dig in the literature more about. I went to a fermented foods workshop and I got so excited that I went from my regular, you know, one cup of Greek yogurt a day to adding kefir and sauerkraut and kimchi, I think it was. And so, like, every day I went from, you know, this small fermented food product to a whole lot, and my eczema went absolutely crazy. So I looked in the literature and found that actually some of these lactobacillus actually do secrete histamines. And you think of antihistamines, right? That's what you take when you have allergies and flare-ups like that. So these are producing histamines that actually cause the flare-up. So, you know, don't go crazy. Don't do the typical American thing and say, oh, just a little bit's great, so a whole lot might be even better. But moderation is awesome.
Don't be ordering a scubby online and starting to do your own kombucha. And
yeah, totally.
Like I did. No, I did.
Well, you know. And
it was fun, but a lot of work.
Yeah, I haven't done that yet. I've mostly stick to yogurt so far.
So how can we get these, you know, people on this GBS thing? Because that's one thing that I find, like you said, the actual risk of it happening, of the complications, is so minimal. But if it happens, it's extremely bad. And then because of that situation, we screen all pregnant women. And right. If they show to be positive, then they get de facto antibiotics during birth, which...
Or before.
Right. Well, so depending on what they're given, but usually you want two doses, and like each place is different, but usually right. It's like two doses with 4 hours separation, and that's the ideal amount of dosing so that when the baby is born, that'll take the care of the GBS as that baby is passing through that vaginal canal. And you took away the GBS, and what else did you, you know, all these other things that you took away just at that moment, you timed it perfectly. Right. That's doing harm.
Yeah, it is. And there's a lot of people working on it. I just think we're not there yet.
Yeah. I personally, that's one of my not pet peeves, but that's one of the things that's close to my heart, because I had, I was GBS positive and had antibiotics with my daughter. And aside from the health effects of having antibiotics right then and, you know, depleting the microbiome, it was annoying. And it was like this added intervention that now I had to figure that there was this thing going in my arm that was hurting. It hurts. And then we got to repeat it every 4 hours. So there's a lot of reasons why it would be great to have an alternative to the antibiotics.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there is, I'm sure, you know, there's a vaccine that people are working on as well, but yeah, time, research dollars, mm-hmm. You know, I think we'll get there because it is something that a lot of people are very worried about.
So one of the common anecdotal things that we're always hearing out there is using garlic cloves vaginally to kind of offset GBS, or even yogurt. Any research on that?
Not that I know of. The idea of garlic cloves just scares the bejesus out of me. To borrow a term from my grandma. Because, you know, garlic is a really, 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 really antimicrobial substance. So you're going to be knocking out all sorts of stuff. And additionally, like, yeah, I'm not big on disturbing ecosystems. So whether it's with something that comes from the ground or comes from, you know, a pill bottle. So as for yogurt, you know, again, it's hard to know. There's more of a chance that you might introduce something that you don't want to introduce accidentally. Yeah, this is one of the few times where I'd be more likely to say, if you want to do anything, sure, a lactobacillus probiotic of any of the vaginal lactose won't hurt you. You know, it might do some good. How it's going to get from your gut to your vagina, I don't know. No one knows that. But again, I'm actually pretty optimistic about these clinical trials with the lactobacillus, that lactin V, I think that, or a 5, I'm assuming it's a 5 and not a V, but I think that that has a really good chance of being something that could change the ratio.
That we'll keep an eye on it. And if you have a link to it, I will add it to show notes so that listeners can keep an eye on it themselves too.
Yeah, totally. I'll send you that link for the show notes.
Fantastic. Thank you. Now, that other study that you were mentioning on the vaginal microbiome, and I just realized, like, at the beginning of the show, I don't know for what reason I turned Australian / British and was saying vaginal microbiome instead of vaginal. I heard myself and I was like, wait, that sounds weird. But anyway, you have a link to it on your site, and I'll add it to the show notes too, so that people can go take a look at it. I was skimming that article.
And the ethnicity one? Is that the one?
Sorry?
Is it the one about vaginal microbiomes and ethnicity? Is that the one
you're talking
about?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So it was the part about ethnicity that was really interesting to me, particularly because I am of Latino Hispanic descent. Like, I am Venezuelan. So, yeah. So that threw a whole different layer of complexity into the situation. Can you explain a little bit the ethnicity part of what this study found?
Yeah, that is such a fabulous study. It's actually one of the researchers at the institute where I'm a postdoc. And so one of the things that Jacques realized is that so many of the studies, and, you know, we've seen this throughout time, right? It wasn't until, what was it, the 1990s that women really started getting studied for medical clinical trials. It was always done on men, white men, and people assumed, oh, it'll be the same way in women, much less ethnic diversity of women. But so similar with the microbiome work, you know, we were focused mostly on white people. But being here in Baltimore and working directly with the medical school a lot, Jacques wanted to look more at the African-American community here and also expand it to Asians and Hispanics. So in their study, mostly refers to African-American, but there are other studies, and some of his ongoing studies are actually with African women as well. What was really amazing is that they see that you can have different community state types of bacteria. So you can have it's kind of like I have a tray of fruit out on our dining room table. And sometimes that tray of fruit has, you know, apples and pears and cherries in it. But sometimes it just has apples and pears. Okay, so those are different community states. So one where it's more diverse and the other where it's not as diverse. So those are different community states. And so what he was finding is there are all these different community states of bacteria that can exist in the vaginal microbiome of different women, but that you find some of these microbiome community types are more dominant in Blacks and Hispanic women than in white or Asian women. And what was interesting about that is that the dominant community state type there is one that's not dominated by lactobacillus. So forever, the medical field has thought that you know, a lactobacillus vagina is a very healthy vagina, and anything that doesn't have lactobacillus is unhealthy and has bacterial vaginosis. Well, what this study really demonstrated, and they've continued to work on this ethnicity angle because it's so interesting and important. It's really important to start, to diversify all of our work in so many different ways. But it was really surprising to see that the majority of African American and Hispanic women had this non-lactobacillus state. And so they would be deemed as having bacterial vaginosis by a doctor. However, they didn't have any of the signs, and they seemed perfectly healthy in every other way. So it really seems like there's this ethnicity component. And again, that can get back to this whole idea of we're not just a microbiome incubator, as much as I kind of like to think of humans as a microbiome incubator. You know, we do have a human part too, and so that's where we can have these interactions between our human genetic self and our bacterial genetic self. And that's really why maybe we're starting to see where sometimes there's a fuzzy answer with either microbiome or human research. Maybe it's because we haven't accounted for ethnicity, or maybe we haven't accounted for, you know, some particular human gene that's influencing our microbiome.
Yeah.
It's cool. But it's also important to say, you know, just because it's not like what we were expecting does not mean it's sick. This is not a sick microbiome. This is not an ill microbiome. This is a natural microbiome state for these women.
Right.
So.
No, and that's so important to underline. Absolutely. And then bringing it back to that GBS thing. I keep going back to it. But, no. That probiotic that's being researched, I think you called it Lacto-B5?
It's called Lactin-5.
Lactin-5.
Yeah.
That's, I'm guessing by the name, very much anchored on lactobacillus.
Yep.
And so then what, if anything, is that going to do to African-American and Hispanic ethnicities?
Yep.
And will it be deemed effective or not? Like, so much, right? Right.
Exactly. Those are the questions we need to be answering nowadays. I mean, and we need to be aware of the impact of ethnicity and diversity on these different studies that we're doing. It's just like, you know, we can't do just mouse studies and say they're going to apply to human. Well, even within humans, you know, it's still, the genes are the same, but there's still some differences there. And those differences seem to be really important when you're dealing with microbial interactions. So I think that's really important. And I don't know, that's one thing that we really don't know is if, because you do have some women that have that non-lactobacillus dominant community state, are other ethnicities as well. It's just kind of how it averages out is that it's more prevalent in Blacks and Hispanic women. So again, you know, each person needs to know their own healthy baseline. But yeah, we don't know how that would, if that makes a difference. Yeah, there's so much, so much fun stuff to figure out.
We will wait optimistically.
Do.
Yes. On a different note, Anne, what about cravings during pregnancy? You know, so far they've been thought to be hormone driven. Is this something that should be reconsidered in light of the increased understanding of the microbiome? Could it be our microbes that are, you know, have craving pickles instead of our hormones?
Oh, totally. Yeah, there've been several different studies kind of indicating that depending on your which microbes in your gut seem to influence what you're craving more or less. And so, yeah, I could totally see that being easily. Well, actually, I guess it's kind of hard to disentangle hormones and bacteria in my mind because, again, with my insect work, people don't think of insects as similar to humans, and there are many differences. But, you know, when it comes to host microbe interactions, sometimes these other systems, it can be a little bit easier to see some of these interactions coming out. And one of the things I saw in one of my insect systems was that the hormones that as the insect went through metamorphosis, as it went from being, you know, a wormy little maggot to being a beautiful fly, you know, there was this huge hormonal shift, and there was a huge shift in how the microbes were. So it makes me really wonder if there isn't this interaction between hormones and microbes, that really there's this crosstalk. Hormones would be an excellent way for bacteria to eavesdrop on what's going on in the host or coordinate with their host, you know, however you want to think about it. So Yeah, sure. Cravings could easily be determined by the microbiome or influenced by the microbiome or hormones or both.
Well, and it makes sense because of, you know, during the beginning of pregnancy, the hormones are changing drastically and all over the place. So, and then you get those crazy cravings or unusual for you cravings.
Yeah. Mine was ice cream with the first kid and spinach with the second one. So, you know, hey.
Nice. Mine was grapefruit.
Oh, wow.
I wanted grapefruit. Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. Huh. It was intensely grapefruit.
That's awesome.
Yay. Who knows what my microbiome was doing?
Yeah, exactly.
And thank you so, so much for this talk. It's been lots of fun.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was assistant professor, researcher, and mother of two, Dr. Anne Estes. Anne is also the human host of the blog Mostly Microbes, which has a section filled with educational modules to help you teach your kids about microbes and the microbiome, and it includes a bunch of kid books reviews. You can find Anne on Instagram at Mostly Microbes Host. And you can connect with us at Birthful Podcast. So, are you worried about pooping during birth? Did this episode help with that? We want to know. Why don't you take a screenshot of this episode on your phone right now if you're not driving and post it to Instagram with your thoughts. Make sure to tag at Birthful Podcast so we can see it and amplify it. You can find the in-depth show notes and transcript of this episode at birthful.com, where you can also learn more about my birth and postpartum preparation classes and download your free postpartum preparation plan. Birthful is created and produced by me, Adriana Lozada, with production assistance from Asia Plati. Thank you so much for listening to and sharing Birthful. Be sure to follow us on Good Pod, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and everywhere you listen. And come back for more ways to inform your intuition.